And proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cashel. My name is Lyle Brenes. I'm the manager for Parks. And today my presentation will be on the feasibility of a pesticide restriction bylaw in Edmonton. To my right is Chris Saunders. Chris works for Parks. He's our environmental manager, and he'll assist me with the presentation as well as to help answer questions later today. I appreciate committee's indulgence. We've asked a couple of additional gentlemen to join us today to try to give you a sense about the framework, the regulatory framework as it relates to pesticides in Canada. So to Chris's right is a fellow named Lindsay Hansen. Lindsay is a regulatory scientist with Health Canada's Pest Management Regulatory Agency, PMRA, and he's here from Ottawa. Lindsay has extensive experience as a toxicologist in conducting human health risk assessment and currently works in the Policy, Communications, and Regulatory Affairs Division of the PMRA. And next to Lindsay is Jock McIntosh. Jock is with Alberta Environment's Pesticide Policy Group. He's a pesticide policy advisor in the Air, Land, and Waste Policy Branch. Jock's work is based in Edmonton, and he administers provincial pesticide legislation, develops pesticide policies, standards, and programs, addresses issues, and provides pesticide consultation services to a variety of provincial and federal agencies. So I'm going first, and then we'll have the two other orders of government follow. In terms of key messages that I want to, extend to you, in 2004, City Council approved an integrated pest management policy, and administration follows that policy to minimize our use of pesticides, to protect and enhance the ecological integrity and function of the city's green infrastructure and other infrastructure in the city. City operations complies with the legal framework that makes up Health Canada's world-class pesticide health and safety system for pesticide use and restriction. And should you wish to consider some sort of pesticide restriction in Edmonton, our advice to you, and that advice will, continue through the day, it should serve a measurable, well-defined objective focusing on some sort of improvement of human health or environmental health. So the report that you received set some context, and then the appendix responded to your questions. So my presentation is going to flow in the same kind of way, setting city context and then answering the questions in the report. The city has about 13,000 hectares of parks inventory, 842 individual parks, a little less than 300,000 planted trees, which provide immense benefits to Edmontonians. Green space improves the city's climate, filters the air and groundwater, creates noise barriers, and healthy trees can even reduce your energy bill by providing shade and cooling the air. The city's planted tree inventory consumes about 3,500 tons of CO2 per year, recycles about 120 million liters of water per day, removes 75% of nitrates found in groundwater, and is one of those assets that actually appreciates with age. Climate change has caused increased loss of trees in Edmonton from drought, and the past decade has been a testament to that. An uncertain future of climate, together with the global marketplace that favors the introduction of more and more exotic species, some of which are weeds capable of invading parks, and others like the emerald ash borer, a pest which threatens urban forest canopies in eastern Canada and slowly moving west. Those and other threats will demand a response that is determined, in our view, by an integrated pest management approach. Some of the response may require the use of pesticides, while others other pests may fail to meet the natural challenges of survival in Edmonton, because winter can be cold here. And we may have some natural defense already in place. Under the city's IPM policy framework, pesticides are used as a last resort, but we use them for four main reasons. Firstly, from an environmental protection perspective, and this is an effort to stop the displacement of native flora and fauna by invasive exotic weed species in the city's natural areas and parks areas. From a legal requirements perspective, to resist the establishment and spread of new invasive species in the region, such as prohibited noxious weeds defined under Alberta's Weed Control Act. And that act has recently added 46 new prohibited noxious weeds. A large reason why we use pesticides is from an asset protection perspective, both in our drainage and stormwater systems, on facilities like golf courses, and as I mentioned earlier, the 1,300 hectares of parks and open space. And from a health and safety perspective, an example here would be managing some of the waterborne pathogens for outdoor water sports events like the International Triathlon Union World Cup in Horlock Park. Despite continual growth in population and green infrastructure, the city has successfully managed its use of all pesticides to minimum levels. And this graph is one illustration of how, for the 4,400 of hectares of mowed turf, we've sustainably reduced conventional herbicide treatment to less than 10% of the inventory for the last 8 years, while maintaining council's and park's weed thresholds. In terms of influencing the pest management culture in Edmonton, there are some examples I'd like to draw your attention to. The first is an impressive one, I think, where through the biological elimination of birch leaf miner pests by parasitic wasps, Parks biologists discovered a native parasitic wasp in the early 1990s, which subsequently eliminated this pest problem through Western Canada, and people don't have to drench their birch trees with Saigon anymore. We also work with the green industry and regulators regarding new registered pesticides and application methods. We've almost completely gone away from canopy spraying of pesticides on trees and instead inject systemic pest control products into the trunk. This reduces exposure to the public and to non-target organisms. Parks also provides a walk-in pest identification service to citizens, providing pest prevention tips and recommendations for least toxic control. In previous years, Parks also provided public education on pesticide reduction through the Good Growing Neighbors program. That program is no longer funded, but it certainly was a good public education activity. These next slides address the specifics of your inquiry. In terms of the legal perspective, a municipal pesticide bylaw can be passed in Edmonton within the jurisdiction of the Municipal Government Act under Section 7A. Prohibitions, however, must not interfere with federal and provincial requirements of landowners to eradicate or control pests. And there is Scott is here from the law branch today if you want to ask questions that are legally based later on. Over the past 20 years, as I think some of you know, at least 172 municipalities have enacted pesticide bylaws across Canada, beginning in Quebec in the early 1990s. In the four western provinces, there are currently 37 municipal bylaws that we found, 35 of which are in British Columbia. There are none in Alberta or Saskatchewan, and two in Manitoba, in Brandon and Winnipeg. There was a fully developed pesticide bylaw drafted in Calgary, but was put on hold by their council in December of 2009. In terms of effectiveness of municipal restrictions in other jurisdictions, we analyzed the effectiveness of some pesticide use restrictions in 8 Canadian cities with populations exceeding 100,000 people to try to get a sense of comparability. Results really showed wide variation in the bylaws in terms of their exemptions, who they are intended to regulate, and that information is found in Appendix 3 of Attachment 1. One of the patterns that we saw was the effectiveness of municipal bylaws are often fundamentally limited by their jurisdiction. And by that I mean if you prohibit the use of a pesticide but it's still legally available for sale, it's sometimes confusing for a homeowner who's told by their city they can't use a product, but they can find it on the shelf of a local hardware store or landscape kind of nursery. The research also went into lists of permitted pesticides that were allowed under the bylaws examined, but we couldn't find any clear scientific rationale for which pesticides were exempted and why others were kept. In our surveying of sampled municipalities, none of them could provide any kind of objective measures of bylaw success, such as lowered pesticide use statistics. All the evidence was anecdotal. And as I said earlier, some of the bylaws through Eastern Canada have been consolidated under provincial legislation. And under that kind of format, at least if you're going to exempt something municipally, if you can't find it for sale, I think it makes it clearer for people in terms of how to approach it. In terms of operational impacts from a bylaw enforcement perspective, our advice has been that enforcement is possible. It's difficult and maybe not that practical, because what a bylaw officer would need to do is, first of all, catch an offender in the act of applying a pesticide that was banned, or to perhaps prove that a banned product was used. So that would require soil testing to confirm that. An early cost estimate by bylaw enforcement for a general municipal pesticide ban sort of begins at around $200,000, but it would depend a little bit on if a restriction was developed and what was in fact restricted. Survey analysis also showed a strong consensus that upfront public education is necessary prior to issuing penalties with a municipal bylaw. Then you asked about operational and cost impacts. So we've given you a couple of different scenarios. One is if a list of softer products were approved and what that might mean. Typically, municipal pesticide bylaws restrict commonly used conventional lawn and garden pesticides such as 2,4-D, but they do allow for softer alternatives. We did some trials using 2,4-D compared with an alternative, a softer product called Weed Be Gone in 2010. And compared to a conventional 2,4-D-based product like Killex, the softer product from our trials required twice as many treatments to achieve the same effect, required five times more active ingredient to achieve that same effect, which is, I guess, a little bit ironic because we actually had to use more pesticide to get the same result. It came in at about 16 times the cost, which across an inventory of 4,400 hectares translates to about a $2.1 million budget implication. If we wanted to ban pesticides altogether and not permit softer products either, what we tried to present here on this slide is some of the cost implications associated with enhancing our cultural practices, which is additional maintenance for parks and open space. And this, of course, assumes that you would want to retain the current aesthetic, the current level of asset protection currently provided by parks. If you were prepared to live with something different, the cost would obviously change. So in terms of those costs, we anticipate an additional cycle of turf and soil enhancement. These are things like top dressing with compost, aeration, and fertilizing, three additional cycles of mowing and trimming, two additional cycles of horticulture maintenance, which is on both mulch beds and soil beds, additional marking for field lines on sports fields. We wouldn't be using any Roundup to burn in the lines. It would just be paint-based. One additional cycle of hard surface weed control and additional money for sports field turf replacement, assuming that we would need to replace more sports field turf than we're currently doing. In terms of golf courses, an expectation if fungicides weren't allowed to be used on greens would that golf green deterioration would not improve, it would be reduced, and they anticipate a revenue loss from poor playing conditions. An annual budget increase of about $250,000 would be needed to increase the cultural weed control on their fairways, and under a worst case scenario, if they had to replace the golf greens, for the three courses at Victoria, Riverside, and Rundle, it's estimated to come in at about $5.6 million. But that would be a worst case scenario if we lost the greens. So in terms of recommended principles for a pesticide restriction, there's three that we'd, if you want to go there, that we'd like you to probably consider. A restriction would be based should be based on an appropriate response to a well-defined human health or environmental problem with a pesticide. I guess for an example, to address health concerns around the use of pesticides, we've consulted with the PMRA and the University of Guelph, internationally recognized toxicologists, on a possible design of a pesticide screening process that would be in addition to PMRA's evaluation of carcinogenicity in pesticides. So if you're concerned that pesticides might be linked to cancer, a restriction could call for additional screening of products that the city is using or products that are available in the Edmonton market. This would demonstrate a greater commitment to public health in the management of Edmonton's urban green infrastructure. We'd also suggest that a pesticide restriction not be a broad-based pesticide ban, but should be selective so as to not restrict pesticide use unnecessarily, and that it should follow an implementation model not unlike what was achieved in 2010 with the elimination of the herbicide-fertilizer combination products, which was a multi sort of pronged effort between ARPA, AUMA, AAMD, and C's in the province to restrict availability of herbicide fertilizer combination products to homeowners. And it also should be monitored for real impacts of the restriction. So if, for example, cancer was a concern, you should understand what the cancer rates are before you begin your restriction, and then measure cancer rates after the restriction's imposed to make sure that you're getting the results that you're intending. In terms of implementation and timelines for a restriction, we'd suggest that expert consultation for the development of a banned pesticide product list should be based on any kind of verifiable links to human health issues such as cancer. We need to draft a bylaw, which would require some public stakeholder and provincial regulator consultation. We'd need to, I think, if you want to try to push it to a point where it's not just municipal but provincial, test support and buy-in from other urban and rural municipalities in Alberta to attempt to get provincial acceptance for a sales restriction. Then to prepare public education process to support the bylaw and enforcement, and then to report back to you. So that timeline is probably in the 18-month kind of range. So before I close, a quick reminder of the three key messages. The city does use an integrated pest management policy. It's council's policy to minimize our use of these products and to protect and enhance the city's green infrastructure. We do comply and in some cases exceed the requirements of the framework that's established by both Health Canada and the province, and that if you wish to consider a pesticide restriction, to think about focusing in on a measurable, well-defined objective towards improving human health or the environment. So now I'm going to shift to Lindsay and let him speak to what Health Canada and the Pest Management Regulatory Agency does nationally. Thank you.